This is Robert Greenall. This is Robert Greenall. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. Thank you very much for joining us today for another edition of Midrats. And for those that are with us live, if you are so inclined, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find access to the chat room, and you can roll into the chat room with some of the usual suspects. And if you have some observations about the show you'd like to share, or if there are questions you would like for us to address to our guests, that's a great way to do it. We'll be watching it during the course of the show. And also, if you have to run off and take care of some errands and the course of the show, and you want to catch up on what you missed, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can just take a shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes or Stitcher. And getting into the subject for today's show, you hear a lot on the edges about China's efforts in the cyber domain, whether it's industrial hacking, suspicion of military espionage, or our ability to access everything from the electromagnetic spectrum to near space operations. The question is, how is she doing this, and what are the reasons that China is doing this, and how does that affect how we should, as a nation, look forward to any possible conflict or aggressive competition with the Chinese nation? And today we have a great guest on to dive deep into the role of China in the cyber domain, and that'll be with Dean Cheng. In addition to being the author of the recently published book that we highly recommend, very data-dense, Cyber Dragon, Dean Cheng has been studying Chinese political and security developments for over a quarter century. He's worked at a variety of the think tanks you might be familiar with, including the Center for Naval Analysis, the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis, and SAC, as well as over at the Heritage Foundation. His research builds on a variety of Chinese materials to bring to light how the Chinese talk about key issues such as space warfare, information warfare, and their own military and civilian decision makers. Dean, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Dean, I wanted to just plow right into that first part that I discussed of the work you do with the Chinese cyber domain, because when the topic comes up about what China may or may not be doing, many times we look at it from an American doctrinal concept. And in your book, Cyber Dragon, one of the things that you bring up early is the importance of understanding how the Chinese look at cyber and information inside Chinese doctrine and strategy. And just to kind of set the table for the show, in big pixels, what are some of the big differences you think that the listeners should keep in mind when the subject comes up?
Well, there's a number of things that we need to start with. So the first, I think, at a very meta-strategic level, is that in a weird sort of way, the Chinese are actually a lot like us. They're a status quo power. We tend to think of them as very anti-status quo, revisionist. But in some ways, they think of themselves as very much in favor of the status quo. The problem is how each of us defines a status quo. We're all of 250 years old, and we pretty much like the world that we created, and we want to defend that. Hence, we're pro-status quo. The Chinese, with 5,000 years of history, view the world through a much different lens, and so they would like to see a world where their situation is returned back. And in fact, Xi Jinping keeps talking about the Chinese revival. So that's the first thing is, are they revisionist? To their mind, they're not. Second of all is, but if they're going to create this world that they want, then they need to be able to succeed in fighting modern warfare. And because they are still Marxist-Leninist in many ways, they believe that war has laws that apply to it. And if you can tease out those laws, you can basically structure your operations in a way that makes sense for that condition. And so they look at the world, again, through somewhat Marxist-Leninist eyes, and they see a world where information is now the currency of power. In the industrial age, you won your conflicts because you could outproduce the other side, sheer mass, tanks, planes, ships. And in today's world, it's the side that can gather information, analyze information, and transmit and exploit information better, faster, more accurately than the adversary. And that, in turn, means that you want to establish information dominance, the ability to do all those things that are information-related better. But you have to start in peacetime. Information is holistic, so it's very blurred to say what is military information, what is economic information, what is technical information, because a lot of that all merges together. Peacetime and wartime are also blurred because you have to collect information in peacetime in order to exploit it in wartime. Everything happens at the speed of information, which means that your ability to gather information, analyze it, you really have to front load. So all of this means that a lot of the things that we see, we tend to focus on individual events, whether it's hacking OPM, whether it is hacking Target or United Health, and we don't seem to put it all together, whereas I would suggest that the Chinese, at a meta-national level and also at a military doctrinal level, aren't focused on cyber per se, individual hacking, individual viruses, but instead have a grander sort of vision that says, in today's world, information is the currency of power. We need to gather all sorts of information. We need to use it better as the means of winning conflict, and there it will be decisive. And all of these activities are part of a grand strategic objective.
Wow, let's, as I'm reading the book, I'm thinking, well, Sun Tzu, Mao, we've got active defense, we've got all the things where you don't want to have to fight a war. A lot of what you discuss in the book is what I would call, and maybe you call, information operations designed to demoralize the other side as part of the active defense. And the word you use, and I don't know if it's a Chinese word that you translated, informationization. Kind of discuss how this what they're doing in the cyber world, and this includes space and all the other things you discuss in the book, but how that fits into the active defense and Sun Tzu, where we might have some small glimpse of what their thinking is on this stuff.
So informationization is the overall effort, as I said in the answer to the initial sort of scene setting, information is the key to the modern age. It's what drives economics, it drives societal development, it drives military capability. So incorporating information and information technology, thinking about information as your main currency, that's informationization. And that's the Chinese term, xingxihua. It's actually been translated in a number of different ways, none of them good, because we don't really have a term that matches. Informatization, informationization, informationalization. But it all basically is the same Chinese term, meaning the application of information to all sorts of activities. And in the military context, it means the exploitation of information in all things. So it's not just weapons targeting. I'm sure many of your listeners have all seen those great videos of from the nose of a Hellfire or the nose of a Maverick, and that's information in terms of guiding a weapon. But to get the weapon there, you had to have command and control. What is command and control? That's information. If you're going to conduct joint operations, what is that? That's sharing information among the participating forces and services. And the people are trained to use information. And so personnel management, who you select, how you train them, that is also impacted by the integration of information technology. Logistics, the role of weather, all of these sorts of things are part, as you recognize the role of information in all of these activities, that's what the Chinese are thinking about in terms of informationization. With regards to Sun Tzu and the whole sort of Asian approach to war, where this comes in is, again, one of the things that I'm sure many of your listeners have heard is, the core of warfare is deception. What is deception? But the denial of information. So in many ways, what we are seeing is, in a sense, the realization that Sun Tzu set out things that you would like to be able to do. You would like to be able to win without fighting. You would like to be able to influence your adversary. You would like to, various types of uses of spies in order to effect deception. And what modern information technology is allowing is the actual realization. Before, when you said you want to win without fighting, you could try, but it's a lot harder to do. And again, modern Chinese writings, military writings, they don't all go around quoting Sun Tzu, believe it or not. But they do say, we have an unprecedented ability to talk directly to our adversaries, decision makers, and population. And we can influence them directly in ways that never was possible before because of the limitations in the past of technology.
I want to pull the thread on that because I think it might help us view what they do in peace vice war. The American military and our traditional allies we work with in NATO are Clausewitzian militaries. We do a little bit of skimming the tops of Sun Tzu just so we have a fancy quote on a PowerPoint slide. And we definitely don't study or incorporate any of Mao's rather incredible record on the battlefield. But the Chinese obviously do more than we do. And in our Clausewitzian world, we have the political or Paul Mell level strategic, then operational and tactical. When they look at the lever of military power, do the Chinese have a similar type of Clausewitzian view, or does that influence of Sun Tzu a little more than in the West, and also the tradition they have of Mao and the People's Liberation Army being more than just a country's army? Does that influence how they are conducting cyber operations in the period before any conflict?
I think someone once very pithily said, the core to Clausewitz is that war is politics by other means, and that the core of Sun Tzu is politics is war by other means. Anytime you oversimplify like that, you always leave things out. But I think that does embody the idea that for us in the West, we have a tendency to do two things. One, we see a very clear line between peace and war, and for most of the West, especially these days, we believe that peace is the default. The military historian Michael Howard wrote a volume, I believe it's called The Invention of Peace, talk about how over the last 300 years, Europe really has developed this idea that there is this separation and that peace is the default. And I would suggest that when we look at Asia, we have a very different approach. We have a very different construct of the fluidity between war and peace. There's much more emphasis on conflict so that you can have conflict even if you're not mobilizing your militaries and you're not engaging kinetic operations. And that this is carried out further in the Chinese context because, one, China still views itself as a relatively poor country. I know that's hard to believe when you're the number two GDP in the world, but when you look at GDP per capita, China falls way out of the top 10. I mean, you're now looking at a much lesser developed country. So they view themselves as poor, and therefore they feel that their resources need to be multitasked. You know, we can afford to have four space programs. China feels that it really can barely afford one in some ways. But the same applies then to its cyber capabilities, its information warfare capabilities. And so the military, which, by the way, is a party army, not a national military, the PLA is the armed wing of the Chinese Communist Party. It does the party's bidding, which above all else is to keep the party in power. But in order to keep the party in power, it helps to do things like promote economic development and economic activity. And so there's nothing contradictory in saying you, the military, are going to use your cyber forces to collect information that may be economically useful, whether it's the formula for certain colors and paints from DuPont, or genetic engineering secrets from Western pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, as part of your task of keeping the party in power and keeping the country strong.
One of the aspects of the book that I thought was really interesting was the Chinese effort to seek all this information from outside and at the same time try and limit the access to their own information from outside forces, plus the need to limit the information available to their population as they try and keep the party in power. Can you kind of discuss this? I mean, it's a whole different way of thinking. In the U.S., we tend to want free flow of information, and we've encouraged that internationally. The Chinese are headed in the opposite direction, and they want to drag the rest of the world with them, as I understand it.
If you are the Chinese Communist Party, your most important task, the thing that keeps Xi Jinping awake at night, is how do you stay in power? And the history of China is very rarely that of being conquered from the outside, but a lot of history of dynastic falls and the government being overthrown. And so the free flow of information, which we in the West take for granted, because at the end of the day, we are stable societies, we have orderly changes of government. From the Chinese perspective, information is very much a threat as well as a tool. It holds within it the possibility of creating another Tiananmen or another May 4th movement or another dynastic succession. So the Chinese see it as absolutely essential to create in cyberspace the same kind of defensive sovereignty that they do in the physical world. And we see the Chinese pushing, therefore, their concepts, their limits on sovereignty, out beyond their physical borders in the South China Sea and places like that. But we also see it in the realm of information space, including the subset of cyberspace. So the Chinese have built the Great Firewall of China, which measurably slows down the flow of information into China from the outside, partly because physically there are only three main portals that connect China to the rest of the global internet. But in addition, the firewall itself, because there's only three access points, literally takes apart, we think, most email, other traffic across, and will filter out unacceptable inquiries, unacceptable requests for information. And you don't do that without paying a cost. The cost is you have a significant slowdown of information passing through that barrier. You also see within China, you cannot have a Facebook account. You cannot have a Twitter account. The Chinese have set up their own companies with their own software. It's not actually all copied. A lot of it is actually quite innovative. For their versions of a Facebook-type entity and a Twitter-type accounts and YouTube and all of those sorts of things. And part of the reason for that is, again, because they saw what happened, for example, in the Arab Spring, where the Egyptian and other governments wanted to control the flow of information through social media, but it turned out that it was all actually in accounts held by Western foreign companies, Facebook, Twitter. So the Chinese basically said, we're not going to accept that. Information flow within China is a national good. It's a national security issue. So there will be Chinese companies, and at the end of the day, they may be private companies, but they'll do what the government tells them to, which includes shutting things down. The physical internet infrastructure is also run by Chinese companies. And so in places like Xinjiang, they have been able to basically turn off the internet, all of it, physical and accounts and things like that, for years at a time. And interestingly, they also set it up, and this is why I say the Chinese can be innovative as well. Government, police, law enforcement, intelligence was still able to have their accounts and physical infrastructure and Twitter and things working, because they were able to basically set it up so that, you know, government accounts would stay open, private accounts, private access to the entire internet could be prevented.
Kind of pulling the thread on that, when you look here in the U.S., there's always people, whenever there's some shutdown or political movement on U.S. campuses, you know, everybody's always concerned that, you know, little Mary and little John going off to college are going to come back with their minds all twisted up with those strange ideas. And when you look at the Chinese, they send a not insignificant number of their best and brightest abroad for college, both in the U.S. and in Europe, and that's been true for decades. I know I went to school with them, and anybody on a major university, especially in the technical fields, are going to see that. As their best and brightest go forward, and even some of them are sending their high school age to boarding schools here in the U.S., especially some of the very wealthy. Has there ever been a concern that they're sending their best and brightest out in their formative years into the West, where you have, relatively speaking, a more open society, a greater access society, a little more free and loose society, that their best and their brightest are going to come back to China and are going to get back behind the Great Firewall and are going to have the additional restrictions? Do they have any concern about with at least in a leadership position, Tiananmen Square is definitely in the back of the mind, any concern about potential cultural blowback as they tighten up their control of information, yet their best and brightest are coming back from a world that's a little more open?
Absolutely. So a couple of parts to your question. Let me try and unpack it a bit. The first is to recognize that there have been actually multiple different motivations, in a sense, almost different waves of students coming here. And so the students that came in the 1980s before Tiananmen are different from the students who have been coming here since. In many cases, you have students who are coming here for the cachet of a Western diploma, to basically say, I went to a Western university, I got a education that is Western, and so if I go back, that will be a huge plus on my resume. You more recently have seen students being sent to the West, meaning that this isn't just a matter of Wu decided that, you know, this would be great for your future, but rather somebody higher up was saying, we're going to send 50, 100, 1,000 students to the top aerospace, nuclear engineering, material science, systems engineering programs in the West. We're seeing more of that. And those are two very different motivations. The students who come here also, there's a very high rate of them not ever going back. There's some Chinese puns, essentially, playing on the idea of sea turtles, hai gui, which is a homophone for basically overseas and coming home. It's enough of a problem that the Chinese government has taken to, in a sense, almost advertising among the population of expatriates, saying, you know, you don't have to move back, but you could come back and teach classes and, you know, impart the knowledge that you have learned back to the motherland. It's really sort of striking how that is, this brain drain is a source of concern. And there's a secondary brain drain issue, which is even some of the people who do go back don't always stay because of the bifurcated system in Chinese research institutions and universities, and actually throughout their entire system, which is you still have party committees. And so you may be the head of a lab, but decisions that you make still have to be approved by the party secretary on the party committee, who is very faithful and very loyal and may or may not be as well educated as you are, but has all of the authority you do, and then some. And that is an aspect that constrains and restrains a lot of people, so that even some of those who do go back eventually chafe and leave again. That, by the way, is another interesting thing to keep in mind, is that China has a much more open flow of humanity than, say, the Soviet Union did. So all of these are factors that the government is well aware of, that you send students abroad, they may not come back. You send students abroad, and they may well be exposed to ideas that are problematic. We believe that among Chinese student associations in the West, not just the United States, there's almost certainly a heavy infiltration of intelligence and party officials and party loyal types who will keep an eye on everyone. And there's the implicit threat at times of, you know, if you misbehave abroad, your parents who are back home, especially if they're senior officials and the like, might suffer for that. All of that, however, we also do need to recognize one other thing, which is an American who goes to Russia or an American who goes to China isn't necessarily going to become a paid agent of Russia or China. The same is going to be true for many, many, many of those students who come abroad, especially those of the most recent cohorts, because they're coming from a China that is economically much more successful, that is politically much more powerful. The gap between China and the rest of the world has shrunk. And so whereas before they may well have been more enticed, if you will, by the appeals of the more industrialized, more modern West, today's younger Chinese students are often very nationalistic and are much more formed in their opinions and are arguably less susceptible to being attracted to the West.
Eagle One? Hello?
Hello?
Oh, well, yep. Looks like my partner has a little technical difficulty. He'll be right back up. Let's do it with something that I found really different. You see this sometimes in a lot of Chinese writings where they have the four of this, the ten of this, the three of this. They like their numbered lists. And you mentioned the Chinese three nons: non-contact, non-linear, and non-symmetric. What do they mean by the three nons, and how might that apply in cyber?
So the Chinese haven't fought a war since 1979, and therefore they have had to really develop their more recent military doctrine, including all of these concepts of informationized warfare, by very close observation of other people's wars, especially those of the United States, partly because to them we are the gold standard. We have been very successful in our wars. And second of all, because we are also the most powerful potential adversary. And one of the things that the Chinese derived, especially from watching the first Gulf War, Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and also our operations in the Balkans, are these three nons. So non-contact, basically that modern warfare often occurs beyond visual range. Now, you know, if you think back to the Battle of Midway, right? The Battle of the Coral Sea. That was the first naval battle in history where the ships of the two sides never saw each other. It was all done by the air wings of the two sides. But for the first Gulf War, many of the weapons were fired, in a sense, beyond visual range. You've basically engaged with laser designators, war GPS guidance, long-range cruise missile strikes. This wasn't onesies and twosies. This was hundreds and hundreds of these munitions. So what the Chinese, their first, you know, sort of derived lesson, therefore, is that future warfare is going to occur at very long range when the two forces are not within direct fire of each other. So that's non-contact. Non-linear has two pieces to it. One is building off of non-contact, that the idea of battle lines, trenches and all that sort of thing, is gone. That you're really going to have a lot of mobile warfare. Forces are going to be mixed up. Rear areas are going to be raided, at least by long-range weapons, but also by special operations forces and things like that. But the other piece to nonlinear, interestingly, is that Mao and others had a very step-by-step idea of the shape of conflict. You start with guerrilla warfare, you start with defensive warfare, you transition to positional warfare, then you go to the offense, and you have mobile warfare, and sort of everything in its place. And what the Chinese have concluded looking at other people's wars is that, again, today's warfare is much more mixed up in terms of phasing, that offense and defense occur at the same time, not just at the tactical level, but at the operational and strategic level, that you could have guerrilla warfare and positional warfare and mobile warfare, each with very different organizations, all at the same time. What we're seeing in Crimea, in a sense, is nonlinear warfare in the sense that it's not phase zero, phase one. It's little green men alongside violent artillery barrages and, fairly significant heavy warfare. And then also you have political warfare and guerrilla warfare all mixed together. And non-symmetrical, one is going to, again, the idea that your best answer to a tank may not be a tank. It may be, a long-range PGM. But the other thing that we sometimes forget is that from the Chinese perspective, we, the West, and especially the United States, are the greatest practitioners of asymmetric warfare. If you are the PLA and you have been told to prepare to defend against American aggression, what mental model should you have for American forces? Is it the military that fought the first Gulf War, 40 days or so of air combat and 100 hours of high-intensity mechanized warfare? Is it the Balkans, where it was pretty much all conducted by long-range airstrikes? Is it the Afghan War, where we toppled the Taliban using special operations forces, indigenous local forces backed by air power and space sensors? Or is it the March to Baghdad in 2003, where heavy mechanized forces, without a 40-day air campaign in advance, basically advances up across the Euphrates and Tigris into Baghdad, scattering the defenders before them, and eventually does the thunder run and topples the statues of Saddam Hussein. I mean, four very different models. How do you prepare a response to that? So from these three nons, what the Chinese took away was the one thing that overlaps among all of them is the importance of information, is the importance of joint operations, creating situational awareness among all of your forces, the ability to apply all of these disparate types of special operations, conventional forces, long-range strike. It all revolves around information. And so that those three nons, in a sense, led to or fed into the evolution in Chinese military thinking that gave rise to the idea of informationized combat and the importance of information dominance.
Which is a good thing to discuss because I think one of your chapters talks about this is not your father's PLA. And as I'm reading it, right now their idea is that they want to get in front of the U.S. information loop and mute us so we can't talk and know what's going on, blind us so we can't see what's going on, confused, so that they get inside our OODA loop. Could you kind of discuss how they've structured themselves to deal with that approach?
So the Chinese talk about informationized warfare is a sort of broad concept, the application of information. Information warfare is more sort of the nutsy boltsy aspect. It is, as an operational level commander, how should you be thinking about dealing with your adversary? I mean, during the Cold War, we were going to get inside the Soviet OODA loop. We had more command and control assets, better sensors, so we were going to make our decisions faster. then the Soviets, with their very top-down command structures, their very limited command and control assets at, say, the battalion level, we were going to be faster than they were. And the Chinese at this point look at the situation and say, we're not sure we can do that, frankly. We're not sure we're flexible enough. We're not sure we have trained and oriented our forces that way. But what we can do is to try and slow down your OODA loop. So there are two ways to beat the other side. One is to be faster than they are. The other is to slow them down to your speed. And at that point, China, which still has the largest military in the world, can then bring its quantity to bear. It's not relying on quantity, but it is going to use its quantitative advantages in order to wear down your adversary as well as to slow down their responsiveness. And so what's striking is that there the Chinese talk about things like integrated network and electronic warfare. Because from the Chinese perspective, where we have tended to view electronic warfare as its own separate thing, the jamming of radios, the jamming of radars, and that's different from cyber operations. Again, for the Chinese, it's all about the information. And so network warfare, which includes cyber, and electronic warfare are two sides of the same coin. One is focused on hardware, one is focused on software. But if I can discombobulate either or both, then you're going to have trouble getting your gathering your information, transmitting your information, and probably even accessing your information. The same applies to psychological warfare. Here at the operational level, it's a matter of inducing questions about how confident are you about the information that's flowing across your screens that you are using to make decisions. If you're not confident in it, you're going to ask for confirmation. You're going to ask for additional sources. You're going to be, you know, you might send the same order across different channels. But all that's going to slow down your process. If you're asking for confirmation, if you are using hard copy when you're used to using soft copy, your decision cycle is slowing down. One of the interesting things is that more recently we've seen the Chinese writing about command and control warfare and intelligence warfare. Within the context of what I just said, integrated network and electronic warfare and psychological warfare, and all of that suggests that from the Chinese perspective, in the transition from the 90s to the 2000s, what they realized was not all high tech is created equal, but for military purposes, but that information technology is especially important, and that in the transition from the 2000s to today, that, again, not all networks, not all electronics, not all commander psychologies are equally important. Those of your top-level commanders and those of their intelligence analysts and briefers is especially important, because if I can influence them, then like ripples in a pond, the downstream effects will be even greater. If I can discombobulate the most senior commander, or if I can induce doubt on the part of his or her intel people, then the decision-making OODA loop will be even slower and will be even more problematic, where their decisions will be even more wrong. And that, in turn, will affect what all the way down to your platoon and fire team is going to be doing.
Well, the follow-up on that is they engage in what I would call influence ops. Are the efforts we see of them, somebody in the PLA, someone in the Chinese world is getting to the OMB, somebody's trying to hack the Pentagon, somebody's trying to get into the major corporations. Is that part of the effort to get an understanding of the, I think you call them key points or key, I call them nodes, of which entities or persons they really need to take out in order to achieve whatever their goal is?
That's certainly part of it. So, I mean, when they hacked OPM, right, they got millions and millions of records. So they got the records of pretty much everybody from the director of Central Intelligence down to your squad and platoon commanders. And with that, with modern social networking software that can map relationships, that can map interactions, with some of the other databases that they hacked, like Ashley Madison, which is a group that basically helps you arrange to have extramarital affairs if you're interested in that sort of thing, you can already see how you have just created the opportunity by hacking these different disparate databases. Absolutely just a gold mine, right? I mean, just Ashley Madison and OPM alone tells me who in, you know, the U.S. government is openly trying to have an affair. I mean, right there, that's your most basic intelligence recruitment tool, because I will bet you most of those people are probably now blackmailable, right? So in terms of influence operations, right there, that gives me a short list of all the people I should be trying to basically hire to become a spy or pressure into becoming a spy for me. But even you take a look at some of the other databases that the Chinese are said to have hacked, those of major health insurance companies like UnitedHealth. That offers a very interesting insight into whether or not you're healthy or not, or whether perhaps your family has people who are not healthy. And are you vulnerable because of rising medical costs? Would a few thousand dollars of a properly timed loan be very helpful at this moment? Do you have children who are going off to school? Are you going to be needing money at this point or at some point in the near future to meet a college tuition or even a private boarding school tuition? So all of these are opportunities to help target, to identify targets for those influence operations. And you're doing all of this in peacetime, because I don't necessarily need you to make a decision right now in my favor. I don't necessarily need you to delay a decision right now. Just don't ask why. Just wait an extra 24 hours. But in time of crisis or war, when minutes, hours, days count, that could be huge. And that's at the open decision-maker level. Then you have other issues of press people and academics and other opinion influencers. And there, too, in the long-term, long-range, how many people are being influenced by Professor So-and-so, who just consistently sort of soft-pedals a Chinese threat perception. Or, you know, stories that hurt China tend not to get covered. Stories that, you know, promote China do tend to get covered here at, you know, Amalgamated XYZ radio station.
That's a great way to make everybody paranoid, which I think is part of the strategy. Strategy too. The Russians and Chinese are having a great time the last few months. And it's, what's interesting about the whole idea of cyber, not just being cyber, but being informational, pretty much any one and zero or wavelength through the electromagnetic spectrum kind of comes under that hat. And another thing, not completely unrelated, when you look at our advertised critical vulnerability that we think is a critical asset, is something that since the Reagan administration really hasn't been above the ambient noise, and that has to do with space warfare, access to and ownership of near-Earth orbit, where everybody's satellites that enable this great global bandwidth capability, for especially for American forces going around the globe. Space and the access to or denial to the resources that are up there, the Chinese also have that playing into their mix. I wonder if you could talk about that for a moment.
So one of the funny things is, you know, folks ask me, how did you get into cyber? And I always say, actually, I got into it because it's totally and absolutely tied up with space. And I've been doing China's space stuff for actually longer than I've been doing Chinese cyber. And got into it in part because there just aren't that many people looking at what the Chinese themselves publish and write on space. But they've been very explicit about the need for space dominance for at least as long as they've been saying that they wanted to establish information dominance. The Chinese recognize that space is the new strategic high ground, and that a huge amount of the information that is used, weather information, we almost never think about weather as a military asset, military, you know, vital source of information, even though D-Day was successful because we had better weather information than the Nazis did. Our ability to communicate, our ability to guide weapons, our ability to coordinate forces, all of that goes through space-based nodes, space-based collection, space-based relay satellites. So from the Chinese perspective, in a sense, space doesn't matter. It's the information that flows across it. But because so much information flows across space systems, therefore space is vital. And let me note for your listeners here, when the Chinese talk about space, they're not just talking about the stuff in orbit. Okay, that's part of the space structure. But when they talk about establishing space dominance, they're also talking about being able to attack the adversary's terrestrial layer, mission control facilities, tracking telemetry and control facilities, launch facilities, and defending their own. And then, and this is where it ties to cyber, you have all of the data links. You have this data links that control the satellites, that keep them in orbit, that point them at the areas of interest on Earth, that allow them to operate. And then you have the data that flows over all of those satellites. So really you have four different pieces there. And space dominance is the need to protect all four and denying your adversary any or all of those four. And one of the other things that, you know, sometimes folks honestly seem to have this idea that China hasn't produced anything on its own. It's all stolen. The space program is a good example, where you look at the Chinese manned space vehicle, the Shenzhou, and they say, oh, that's just a Soyuz. First off, it's not. It's significantly bigger, has a lot more power generating capacity, has a lot more onboard sensors and other things than the Soyuz ever did. But what we are seeing, for example, is China is going to land a probe on the far side of the moon, sometimes described as the dark side of the moon. So they're going to land a probe. It's going to go out there with a little rover. It's going to pick up some samples. No one's ever done this before. No one has ever landed on the far side of the moon. Now, to land on the far side of the moon and get information means you have to communicate with the far side of the moon, the part of the moon that never faces Earth. So in order to do that, the Chinese are going to deploy this year a communication satellite to one of the Lagrange points. There are five Lagrange points, and Lagrange points are where the gravity of the Earth, Sun, and Moon sort of cancel each other out. It's sort of a dead space, if you will, in the Earth, Moon, Sun gravitational system. So anything that deploys there stays there. So the Chinese are going to be the first country to put a permanent communication satellite into one of the Lagrange points. The reason why this matters is because the Lagrange points are far beyond geosynchronous. Up until now, we've always thought of geosynchronous as the most valuable real estate in space. Geosynchronous points in space basically are always looking at the same spot on Earth. So a lot of communication satellites, missile early warning satellites, things like that are put out there. The Chinese have just basically said, we're going to open up the volume of space between the geosynchronous belt, about 24,000 miles out, and the moon. That's a giant, huge volume of space. It means that they're going to have, in a sense, on-orbit reserves. They are going to have capabilities that they can exploit in addition to stuff that we already know about. And as you go farther and farther out into space, it becomes harder to track them. So you could lose things in the shuffle out there. That's a lot of capability that the Chinese are openly saying, we are going to develop this, we're going to exploit this, and it absolutely will have military consequences, but it's something that doesn't seem to be getting much attention at all.
Thanks.
My boss says that I'm the most optimistic person he knows.
Well, he has a very dry sense of humor, I gather. I'm in chapter 8 of your book. You do discuss, thankfully, as I was reading through this, you make some suggestions of how the U.S. and other people who are affected by what China seems to be up to can respond to China's desire to gain information dominance. Could you discuss briefly, or as long, take as long as you want, discuss some of these ideas you have as to how we can resist this the Chinese efforts?
Well, I mean, one of the funny things is that we look at what the Chinese are doing, and we, y'all sort of wring our hands and we say, oh my gosh, y'all, how are we going to stop them? And the first thing that I would really suggest is, you know, try the book itself tries to lay out how the Chinese look at information. And the same applies to thinking about the solutions to the problem, which is, you know, the Chinese don't necessarily see themselves as in an advantageous position. They see themselves as being challenged. They see themselves as being on the short end of the stick, in no small part because, at the end of the day, we're actually more stable, hard to believe, especially with the debate these days, but really the Chinese certainly believe this, that we are more politically stable than they are. This goes to the earlier question, for example, about why did the Chinese have the Great Firewall of China and all those sorts of things? Because Xi Jinping goes to sleep at night not sure whether or not he's going to wake up with his head on his shoulders or not. At the end of the day, you know, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, they're not particularly worried about any of those sorts of things. That means that they are the ones who see information as ultimately a very, very dangerous thing. And we surf the waves of chaos that we generate. We are comfortable with huge amounts of information. Whether or not we use it wisely is a different issue. But, you know, we do live in a world where we're comfortable with the idea of dozens of different opinions. And we get our backs up when the government tries to tell us what to think. And that's a fundamental strength that is our starting point. Now, this goes to a couple of things. The Chinese, one of their advantages is that they recognize that we are in competition and to a large degree in conflict. We're not at war with each other. We trade with each other. We're each other's largest trading partners. But to their view, our very system is a challenge to them. Not because we set out to do that, but because of what I just said earlier. We believe in freedom. Freedom is corrosive. Freedom is disruptive. Freedom is fundamentally anti-status quo. We want change. We like change. The Chinese very much would love to live in a world where everything just went into stasis for the next 20, 50, 100 years. And because they view the competition as all-encompassing, it does mean that we need to be thinking not just in terms of military responses, although hard power has its role, but to also recognize that part of it is that appeal. When all of those students come over here and some significant percentage, 30, 40%, you write off the bat as never going back to China, that says something about the Chinese system. So to what extent can we succeed basically doing what we're already doing, which is to say promoting freedom of expression, freedom of difference of opinion? Now, getting some of that behind the Chinese firewall becomes much more of an interesting challenge. And there, too often we're doing our own goal problems, right? We are the ones who help set up the international governance structure for the Internet. And then in the previous administration, we are the ones who walked away from it. And the Chinese and Russians grab that and are grabbing it with both hands because they understand if they can control the governance structure, the free flow of information gets constrained. So why did we do that? Darned if I know. But that's an own goal. That, you know, we can't. If we're going to throw away that kind of power, it's not the Chinese and Russian fault that they picked it up. Another aspect of this is that we should recognize that, along these lines, if the Chinese can access our information, how much of that is because we left the front door unlocked, left the key to the back door under the welcome mat, and left a note to the milkman saying, come on in the back door and leave the milk in the fridge? I mean, to what extent, you know, the Internet itself was never designed to be secure. It was also never designed to have, you know, half the planet on it. But do, you know, for your listeners, do they have up-to-date antivirus software, do they make sure that it is updated regularly? And if they work for a company, I don't care if you make soft drinks or you make snack food or you make drugs. The idea that, well, if we're not in national security, we're not a target for the Chinese is just plain wrong. You are part of the American economy. Therefore, you are something that contributes to the American economy and its strength. And you will be targeted, whether it is the production or packaging and food preservation techniques for snack food, or whether it is, you know, genetic engineering for bacteria that can help protect corn crops. That can and is of interest to an economy that is heavily still state-run. And what you may not value, your email files, your email lists, is something that when I put it into a social engineering and mapping software can give an enormous amount of data away. So are these, there's no excuse for you to come into my house and steal my food, ever. But if I leave, like I said, if I leave the doors and windows unlocked and tell everyone that I'm not home, you are kind of inviting trouble. And then the last part here is to, again, recognize that we are in a conflict. And I think that for the military and our national decision makers, probably nothing has been more detrimental than this whole phasing concept, where if we're in phase zero, we're not at war. And that's not DOD's problem. That's State Department, and that's strategic communication, but it's not conflict. You know, when the bullets start flying, then it's, you know, and we'll have discussions of titles and authorities. And it's like the rest of the world doesn't work that way, especially authoritarian regimes like that in Beijing and that in Moscow. They think whole of society, not just whole of government, whole of society. They will put companies and businesses to work. They will put their academics to work. They will put their media to work. We can't do that, and we wouldn't want to live in a society that does, but we need to at least be thinking about it more along those lines. Sorry for the soapbox.
No, we built a soapbox. We invite people to stand on it. As we get near the end of the hour, one question I wanted to roll your way is, as I was reading your book, Cyber Dragon, as we have talked today, I kind of, and I'll apologize to you if you don't have your bingo card with you, but it reminded me of one of the overused buzzwords of the previous year that we've done a lot over on our side, and that's the third offset strategy. In their approach to cyber and information from Lagrange points down to fibers going across the ocean floor. Do the Chinese kind of look at that the same way that some national defense thinkers here in the U.S. are talking about the third offset, is looking for a technology or technique or some type of procedure that can give you a workaround or a shortcut around what is a very challenging national security challenger?
I can say with great confidence that the Chinese read everything we produce. And by we, I don't just mean the United States. I mean the West, French, Israeli, British analysts. You can find translations of the various JPUBs from the Joint Staff, the NCO Guide. The author of the NCO Guide actually sent me an authorized translation from China and asked me to take a look at it, and they had translated it accurately. I flipped through it and sent it back and said, except for one very brief chapter up front, which was basically simply giving a description of the American NCO Corps and its roles and the place of this volume in that context, this is as good a, you know, pretty much word-for-word translation. There's no warping or altering of concepts here. So the Chinese have absolutely been keeping track of what has been going on with the third offset strategy. I think the interesting questions are going to be, now that we have a new president, and apparently we are jettisoning the third offset strategy in favor of, I think it's now multi-domain operations and multi-domain deterrence. One, do we still know what the third offset is supposed to mean, whatever we call it? And then before two, how will the Chinese respond? And I strongly suspect that the Chinese were never going to orient themselves per se towards countering the third offset strategy. I think that they, in a sense, have their own concept of what future warfare will look like, wars under informationized conditions, that they will take into account whatever the third offset developed in terms of technology. But at the end of the day, what it really, you know, what the third offset seemed to be about was the use of technology to empower lower and lower level units. Well, at the end of the day, that still came, probably comes down to the ability to gather and exploit information and use it well. And so in some ways, I do sometimes wonder whether or not, amidst all the buzzwords and things, whether we're the ones perhaps who are becoming the near peer competitor compared to the Chinese, who have much more methodically, it seems, thought about what is the nature of future conflict, what kinds of capabilities do I need, what kinds of capabilities will I therefore acquire, what kinds of people will I recruit and how will I train them, what kind of doctrine do I need to make best use of those capabilities, and most recently, how do I reorganize the People's Liberation Army, which is what they have done, in order to exploit all this new technology and put into effect all of these new doctrines that I have been doing, that I've been developing over the course of 20 years? Are we the ones who are becoming the near-peer competitor? Not necessarily in terms of individual pieces of technology, but in terms of bringing it all together holistically, the organization, the bureaucracy, the doctrine, the training, the mindset.
Well, Dean, I don't want to take we don't want to take up any more of your time, although I've got about 300 more questions, and you just raised a whole new set of things we could ask about. But really appreciate you taking the time this afternoon to come join us. We'd love to have you back at some later time, and maybe we can go into further conversations. Let me commend to the listeners your book, Cyber Dragon. It was available on Amazon, although last time I checked they were out of stock and are apparently going to get some more, but it is an information-dense read. It is fascinating reading. My thought while I was looking at it was sort of like The Hunt for Red October. There's stuff in there that I wish I didn't know now, but good stuff. Again, thank you very much for being with us today, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime in the future.
Well, thank you again for having me. It's been a great honor, and I do hope that you'll invite me back.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dean. It's been a great show, and I wish you well in 2017. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you. Take care.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Till next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy day. Cheers.
Woo!